stand a chance. Suddenly utterly weary, Mortis lifted his battle-axe, blood dripping down the handle and along his fists. He turned to face his final foe. Blinked. Lord Farley Loren was gone, running for his very life. Though bone-weary, Mortis gave chase. Now he was the baying hounds, the tracker. Farley was the prey, the scared rabbit without a hole to hide in. The man was clearly frantic, because he didn't even have the sense to flee in the direction of his army, but back eastward, as if he could make it the hundreds of miles to the spear and disappear into his own territory. Even there you would not be safe, Mortis thought. The distance separating them evaporated under Mortis's long strides. Twice Farley glanced back, and Mortis could see it, the white fear, the recognition. He knows who I am. Mortis closed the remaining distance with three long strides, leaving his feet to tackle his prey, using his momentum and the weight of a decade of brewing anger and fathomless sadness to crush his foe beneath the landing. The man shrieked, trying to protect his face with his arms. Farley was already whimpering by the time Mortis grabbed him, slamming him onto his back. He tried to go for his sword, which was still in its scabbard, but Mortis held his arm fast and drew the edge of his axe to his throat.
"Please,"
Lord Farley begged, his countenance stricken with fear. Gone was the arrogance. Gone was the bravado. Mortis didn't want to listen to another word, but instead of this man's face, all he could see was her. After the night of their first kiss, she'd left him, her gait light and almost whimsical, the moon's light playing across her shoulders, one of which was bare, her dress having slipped down somewhere during the moment. Mortis had longed to touch that skin, kiss it. Scarlet had turned back just before disappearing around a bend. She'd smiled. It was a smile of happiness and a kept secret, the truth of which was locked up when their eyes met. She loved me that first night, too, Mortis realized. The thought sucked the breath from his lungs, because for some reason he'd always believed it had taken her longer to reach a conclusion he'd come to almost immediately. But no. Their connection had been shared from the same moment, from that first magical kiss. And now, that truth was enough to sap the last of his energy, his hand falling away from the man who'd taken everything from him. He slumped to the side, defeated by himself. By her. He could only see her now. The real world encased in iron.
"You were supposed to fight for me," she said.
Spoken by those perfect lips, the words destroyed him. "I tried. I would have if I had known."
"No,"
she said, shaking her head. Something was off about her face. Her nose sharpening, her features changing. Her hair turned to spun gold, curling slightly. Her lips hardened into a sneer. Her eyes lightened and rounded more, her lashes thinned. Lord Farley stood over him, the moon's light cracking through the clouds and painting half of his face, making him appear to be a monster born of shadow and light in equal measure. He held Mortis's own axe in two hands, though the instrument looked unnatural in his grip, cumbersome. But Mortis didn't care, for this end felt right. Not in terms of justice, for where was there justice in a world where a girl as beautiful as Scarlet could be killed in cold blood? But in terms of what he deserved. Even though he knew she would never have blamed him for her death, he did. If he had gone to her sooner that night, or inquired more about what the lords of the castle did to her and the other maidservants, or if he'd been more aware of the darkness in a world that had become, for him, painted in rainbows and flower blossoms, everything could have been different. Farley raised the axe, his arms trembling.
"Oh, Scarlet, I'm coming. After all these years, I'm finally coming."
Mortis didn't see the arrow, only felt the subtle displacement of air and the unzipping sound it made as it cut through the night. The impact was so powerful that the tip protruded from one of Farley's ears while the iron feathers stuck from the other. The axe dropped from his hands behind him, and they fell together, landing at almost the same instant. Mortis stared at the cloudy sky, at the empty spot where his would-be killer had stood only a moment earlier, the killing stroke mere seconds from falling. A rustling sound filled his ears, but he didn't turn to locate it. Just stared at that sky, at the grey clouds moving over him like ships across a stormy sea, occasionally silvered at the edges by the light from one or both moons. It was beautiful, the night, Mortis realized. He hadn't thought such a thing in a long time. And then the rustling stopped, and Sparrow was there. Not standing over him, like the conquering hero that she was, but falling to her knees at his side, much like he'd done on the night that changed his world, and brought him to this very place all these years later. Her expression was one of fear, her brow furrowed as her gleaming eyes searched him for injury. "I am unhurt," Mortis managed to say, though it was a lie. The concern fell away, and she pressed her body against him, cradling his head in her hands. He relished her warmth, like a cocoon of healing. For the first time since they kissed all those years ago, he didn't feel completely awful for the feelings he'd long held for this woman of the Iron Forest. He could still see Scarlet in his mind, not as she was at the end, blooded and broken, but as the vibrant, beautiful maiden he'd fallen in love with. And she was smiling. And he knew he had her blessing, had always had it, even if he didn't feel worthy of such a thing. He didn't kiss Sparrow on this night, though he would many, many times, but he did hold her for hours, until long after the battle was over, the enemy routed, their thundering retreat flowing past like winds chased by the howls of wolves. 10 years later, Mortis painted a single finger along the swell of Sparrow's hip, feeling her tremble slightly beneath his touch. The years had stolen none of the restless energy that seemed to connect them. "She is so beautiful," he thought, watching her chin lift to expose her neck, the skin as supple as cured leather. An invitation, which he gladly accepted, kissing her, painting her with fire. Clad in armor, Sparrow was a warrior. Like this, she was his, and he was hers. He still loved Scarlet, would love her until time cracked the earth into two pieces like a split piece of wood, but he loved Sparrow equally. There was no competition between them for his heart, for such a thing was foolishness when death separated two lovers with an impenetrable wall. He reached her chin, growing hungrier but forcing himself to linger on each spot of skin, to draw out the moment before their lips met. It was fire in the dark, sunlight in the shadows, stars exploding in the night sky. A feeling that would never grow old. And, surprisingly, it was the same moment that his thoughts strayed to another place, grabbing hold of an idea that had been sneaking around the edges of his mind for years. The last 10 years had wrought much change on the East. Though the animosity had only grown between the East and West, such hate was not shared by all on either side. Mortis had opened the hearts of the Aurians to the idea that perhaps not all colonizers were to be feared. Instead of attacking new settlements, the Aurians had sent Mortis as their ambassador, inviting the humans to visit Ironwood. Many opted to stay, learning the ways of the Iron Forest and its people. Many became legionnaires, willing to fight for this magical place. But there was something missing, Mortis knew. He'd known for a long time. He could see it in his mind, and it was beautiful. "Where are you?" Sparrow asked, drawing him back from his reverie. He blinked, stared into those piercing eyes that were his to stare into. "What?" he said. "You stopped kissing. And you know I grow angry when you stop kissing." Oh, how he loved this woman. And though he knew she was more than capable of protecting herself, he also knew he would die to keep her safe. But there were other ways, too. The Calypsians had been growing ever bolder on the southern border, and there were rumors that their dragons had reached maturity. It was more a matter of when, not if, they would attack. "Our defenses are stronger than ever," Mortis thought, but it wouldn't be enough against dragons. The forest was simply too big.
"We need to build a city," he said now. "An iron city."
Sparrow's lips parted slightly, and she laughed, the sound like music to Mortis's ears, even though she was mocking him.
"You silly humans, always needing to conquer everything."
But Mortis didn't want to conquer the forest. He wanted his city to be a part of it. He explained everything, and by the time he was finished, Sparrow's eyes were as full of excitement as he suspected his were.
"And what will you call this city of iron?" she asked.
The name came to him like it had always been there, just waiting for this exact moment.
"Feria," he said.
Postlude 2. Fey Dar. The Northern Kingdom, Blackstone, circa 520. Fey Dar wasn't always Fey Dar. No, she was born Rose Smith, a name she'd once been proud of. Roses were the finest of all flowers, after all, and she was the finest blacksmith in all of Blackstone, perhaps even the entire Frozen North.
"Then why am I so miserable?" she thought now.
Once she might have believed her depression stemmed from the loss of her parents in short succession several years earlier. Her mother had been kicked by a horse. Her father, her teacher, her best friend, her confidant, withered away with a broken heart shortly thereafter. But she knew that wasn't the root cause of her melancholy, only a contributing factor.
"Lord Blackstone," she thought now.
The man, yes, but not only.
The job.
She'd initially fallen into the employ of the most powerful noble of the Northern Kingdom's largest city, a year after her father's death. The position was gained through a well-connected friend of her father, who'd been determined to help her. A friend who was now dead.
"Because of me," she thought, "like so many others."
Her job was simple. Outfit the soldiers of Blackstone with steel and armor, weaponry and shield. The truth was infinitely more complex, and getting more complex by the day. Lord Blackstone was a greedy man, as miserly as the day was long, but he was also practical, and when he'd first explained the reasons for the changes, Rose had assumed the decision was made from a place of necessity.
"Make the infantry's armor smaller and thinner," he'd said. "I want them to be fast. It will save lives in the long run."
It had also saved the Lord 30% more coin in the short run. And, Rose now realized, as she stared at the Lord, no percentage of coin would ever be enough for Lord Blackstone. Not until his lowest class of soldier was fighting in naught but cloth napkins and wielding rolled-up parchment as swords.
"Excuse me," she said,
even though she'd heard him perfectly well the first time. Lord Blackstone's thin eyebrows were sharpened to black points on each end.
"The formal orders will be delivered to your office. I came as a courtesy."
He turned and stalked off. He would be obeyed without question. Rose seethed. The first time the armor requirements for the light infantry had been altered, Rose had obeyed without question. She still remembered the blood-stained fragments of sheared armor that had been returned to her to be used as scrap metal. So the second time she had questioned, and her well-connected friend, who'd helped her land the job in the first place, had been threatened. So again she had obeyed. Lord Blackstone had had him killed anyway, to send her a clear message.
Obey or pay the price.
This was now the third time in 3 years she'd been commanded to reduce the weight and size of the infantry's armor. As she looked at the requirements set out in the formal orders, her mouth gaped open.
"Hundreds will die who might have been protected," she thought. "Maybe thousands."
She shook her head, trying to understand. Why would Lord Blackstone want to see his own army decimated on the front lines by their enemies?
Just to get richer?
Something about it didn't feel right.
"I'm missing something. I must be."
Regardless, she knew she had to do something. Rose did what she did best. She forged. A fortnight later, when the new design was perfected, she wiped the grime from her cheeks, which only made her cheeks grimier, and released a deep sigh of satisfaction. The new armor was an original composite, forged of 6 different types of metal, 5 of which were inexpensive and could be easily procured. The 6th, while not inexpensive and less readily available, was used in such small quantity that it didn't inflate the overall price of the suit too much. All said, she was within the budget specifications provided by Lord Blackstone. Additionally, the armour was, in fact, thinner and lighter, giving the infantry the added benefit of greater speed and agility. It was a once-in-a-generation breakthrough, and, although it pained her to admit, would not have been possible if not for Lord Blackstone's greed. Finally, Rose would be able to protect the soldiers she'd been charged to protect and satisfy the Lord's growing treasury. All that was left was to present it to the Lord of Blackguard himself.
"I love it," Lord Blackstone said, after a thorough demonstration had been conducted.
Rose's new armour had been placed on a dummy constructed of animal skins stitched together and filled with water. Then it had been attacked mercilessly by swords, arrows, and even hammers. Save for a few dents, the armour had held up incredibly well, so much so that none of the skins were leaking so much as a drop of water.
"You have truly outdone yourself," the Lord added, running a hand over a sample of the metal.
Rose didn't smile so much as beam. For the first time in years, she felt happy, like she'd accomplished something worthy of her father's legacy. This was what she was meant to be doing, not churning out flimsy armour for foot soldiers meant to die. Lord Blackstone's fingers played with the hairs of his goatee, twirling them together and plucking at them. He sat on Blackstone's royal seat, a gaudy velvet chair with golden tassels dangling from the arms. Behind him was an enormous tapestry depicting a battle between the North and the West. It was the bloodiest battle of the Hundred Years' War. It was said 1,000 men had died every hour.
"What of the new design for the infantry?" the Lord asked now. "Has that been completed yet?"
Rose's smile vanished.
What? This is the new design,"
the Lord scoffed.
"Smith, what makes you think I would outfit my lowest-level soldiers in armour of this quality? This is armour fit for a lord, and I will wear it proudly, as well as my top generals. You should be honoured by such a fact."
"Honoured?" The word felt like a slap, drawing heat to her cheeks. "Thousands will die on the front lines." She knew she was being far too bold by half, but couldn't help herself. The Lord waved her protest away.
"Bah! Thousands will die regardless of what we do. This is a war. Men will die. Must I remind you?"
The last part was a threat, she knew. To her, to anyone she cared anything about. Though she preferred being alone these days, she occasionally went for a drink with her Smiths. She wouldn't call them her friends, exactly, but she couldn't bear the thought of any of them disappearing simply for being associated with her. Her mouth hung open, but all further arguments died on her lips. It left her feeling cold and useless.
"Dismissed."
The word was like a dagger to the heart, not because it was a sharp command, but because it wasn't. Instead, it was uttered with a casual indifference that demonstrated just how untouchable Lord Blackstone believed himself to be. She would design the new infantry armour to the Lord's exact specifications. Rose felt ill. The new armour she'd designed for the infantry not only was inferior, but looked it, constructed of used metals of dubious origin.
"Thousands of soldiers will die because of me," she thought.
She could see her father's eyes in the back of her mind, his disappointment. But what was she to do? She could refuse to follow the Lord's orders, a crime which would result in her execution. She could brook another argument, but he would only threaten, or worse, hurt, someone she was associated with. She could run away, but even that was a hollow idea, cowardly, because someone else would only fill her shoes. Soldiers would still die, needless deaths she could have prevented. But how? She left the forge and crossed the snow-blown area to the castle's side entrance. She didn't have a plan, not really, but knew she needed more time. Surely Lord Blackstone couldn't deny her that. She could make excuses about the specifications being more of a challenge than she initially believed, and he would trust her because none had ever openly defied him. She froze, hearing voices echoing from an open door on the right. The door that led to the grand hall adorned in bloody tapestries of battle and death. Voices filled with mirth, laughter. She peered around the corner. From afar, the individuals were hard to make out. Lord Blackstone for certain was there, his voice as familiar to Rose as an old scar. The other two, she soon realized, were the Lord's top generals, Drummond and Wheeler. Not once had they objected to the changes to their soldiers' armor, a fact that had never sat well with Rose. She'd always believed they were sheep, but now they were co-conspirators.
"If the last battle was any indication," Drummond was saying, "if we lose 1,000 men, they will be replaced by 3,000, maybe more. Not to mention the tax coin that will be sent our way," Wheeler added. "A 50% increase, at the least, I'd say."
More laughter, Lord Blackstone's loudest of all, a booming tone that reverberated through the hall.
"They want their infantrymen to die," Rose realized with horror. Suddenly it all made sense to her. The more men they lost on the front lines, the more their sacrifice would be recognized in Castle Hill, where King Garrick resided. Military resources would be reallocated, funneled to Blackstone. Coin, too, filling their coffers to overflowing. Getting richer and more powerful off the blood of their own men. It was criminal. It was horrifying. Rose wanted them to be punished. Perhaps it was the adrenaline, or the feeling of being backed into a corner. But in that moment, an idea sprang into her mind. Yes, it would cost her everything. Her job, her livelihood, her reputation, perhaps even her life. But it would cost Lord Blackstone, too. Oh, yes, it will cost him dearly.
"This looks no different to your other design," Lord Blackstone said, peering at the armor.
He ran a finger along the surface of the breastplate, curling his nose as it came away sheened in a layer of fresh oil. It had taken her all night, but she'd accomplished her goal. Rose kept her tone even, though her heart galloped in her chest.
"True, which is another of its benefits. The infantry will believe they are adorned in the same armor as the lords. They will fight harder for you."
To demonstrate, she stabbed a sword at the armor. Unlike the previous test, in which the blade would have deflected solidly off the metal with a tonal clang, this time the blade pierced the armor with a loud squeak. The stitched skin inside burst, and water pumped from the wound. The Lord licked his lips at the appealing prospect of his men fighting even harder for him. Or perhaps it was the thought of them dying that delighted him. His eyes narrowed a moment later.
"How will we tell the difference in the sets of armor?"
Rose smiled, as if sharing a secret between them. She lowered her voice to a whisper, gesturing to a spot on the other set of armor she'd brought, the original design. There was a marking there, engraved on the left breastplate. A sword crossed with an axe, a crown hovering between them both.
"Only your armor will bear this symbol. That is how you will tell."
The Lord smiled back. It was a devil's smile. 3 months later.
"It is done," Rose thought.
There was no turning back, not that she wanted to. 4 months, she and her smiths had toiled to forge both types of armor, thousands of sets of plate for the soldiers and much less for the Lord and his ilk. Lord Blackstone himself had requested she march into battle with him, so she could see the fruits of her labors.
"Oh, I will see the fruit," she thought.
"It might not be as sweet as you expect, however." The Lord hadn't even tested the armor he was provided with. He feared nothing. Even if he had, Rose had been prepared for it. One spot on the chestplate was forged of the new composite, and she could have stabbed it 100 times and it wouldn't have torn. The rest was weak. She'd purposely kept her smiths ignorant to the ruse. Only she knew which armor was which, and it was she who'd etched the symbol in each one. There were just over 100 marked suits, which had been provided to Lord Blackstone and his ignoble entourage. The rest of the armour was sent to the infantry, who marvelled over the crisp, lightweight feel. Now, beyond the dark, spear-like spires that marked the Blackstone coastline, Rose saw the Western Armada. More and more the Westerners, under the command of King Loren, had taken to attacking the northern shores. Blackstone was the first and only line of defence, which was one of the reasons the sprawling city had grown so much in the last decade, as all types of merchants and tradesmen and women flocked to the city to meet the needs of its burgeoning military. And all the while the city's top lord grew wealthier. Rose watched as the ships made landfall, despite a barrage of flaming arrows soaring in flocks to repel them. Western soldiers splashed into the water, cut down by more arrows and other projectiles sent ploughing into them by northern catapults. Rose held her breath, wondering whether the enemy would gain enough ground for her subterfuge to be discovered. They did, clambering over the rocky shoreline and breaking across the snow-dusted incline that led all the way to the city, still several miles away. The first to meet them was the infantry, of course, charging with a war cry which, even distant, sent chills up Rose's spine. Steel met steel. Men fought. Men died. All while Lord Blackstone watched from a safe distance, clad in armour he believed was 100-fold superior to that of the men doing the actual fighting. Rose tried not to look at him, waiting for the moment when the West's usual tactics were implemented. The fighting grew in intensity. The northern infantry slowly pushed back under the onslaught. However, unlike the past few battles, not nearly as many lay dead on the field. "They are fighting well," one of the generals said, Drummond, clad in shining armour. "Why aren't they dying?" Lord Blackstone said. Rose wondered if he'd forgotten she was here, speaking openly. Or perhaps she was of such little consequence he didn't care if she heard the truth any more. Rose felt his eyes on her, cold, calculating.
"Smith, do you have an answer?"
She did, but she wouldn't speak it. She was still waiting for the Westerners to employ their usual tactics. Instead, she delayed the truth with another lie. "I reinforced their armour with the composite you now wear," she said. "They are nearly as well protected as you."
"Better, in fact. Much better."
Finally, she turned to meet Lord Blackstone's gaze, just so she could witness his face turning red with anger and disbelief.
"You did what?" he growled.
"Never fear," she said smugly. "You will win this battle and live to fight another day."
"Not likely. The live and fight and another day parts, that is." "You will suffer for this,"
the Lord spat. But she was already turning away, sensing a change in the battle. The Westerners had formed a staunch barrier, at least a dozen lines thick. Distance archers took up position, aiming over the heads of those clashing at the front.
"You and all you care about."
"Good," Rose said. "Thankfully, I don't care about anyone but myself. Now, you should probably duck."
As she said the last, she knew it was too late, because she'd already seen the arrows take flight, was already diving for the ground herself. And the Lord and his two generals, who hadn't even bothered to carry shields because of how secure they felt in the quality of their armour, were too shocked to do anything but stand, blinking in the sunlight. The arrows fell amongst the nobles and generals like rain. One pierced General Drummond's shoddy helmet, stopping only after it had entered his skull. His eyes went blank and he was dead before he hit the ground. Another three arrows sheared through General Wheeler's armour like it was constructed of paper and twigs, which wasn't far from the truth. Blood spouted like hot water erupting from a geyser. He cried out, a watery gurgle. Dozens of other nobles were hit, too, dropping like flies, while the lowest of their rank, the infantry, survived. It might have been fate or a cruel karma, but as Rose hunkered beneath her own shield, she watched as every arrow missed Lord Blackstone, who had still not taken cover, watching as those he trusted most were devastated and blooded. But then, just as his confused eyes swiveled around to meet Rose's stare, a final arrow hit, entering through the exact spot where she had etched the symbol, the exact spot beneath which his black, evil heart was beating. until it wasn't. His eyes rolled back, and he fell to his knees, his mouth gaping as if he was trying to say something. But he would give no further commands, make no more threats. Not in this life, anyway. He clutched at her ankles, but there was no strength left in his hands. She moved away, feeling nothing but a sense of justice.
"May you rot in frozen hell," Rose thought.
And then, when she was certain it was safe, she slid out from under the shield and ran. Lord Blackstone had 3 sons, and once the truth of her actions was learned, she knew they would search every nook and cranny in the city to find her. No, Rose Smith could no longer exist. 2 months later. Walberg wasn't such a bad place. The citizens were honest people who worked hard and desired little but health and happiness and food on the table. Under a false name, Rose Smith, now Faye Dar, would stay as long as she could, though she suspected one day she would be forced to leave. Rumours and speculation regarding the events that had transpired during a battle near Blackstone were still swirling in most pubs and taverns, like the one she sat in now, and it was said the streams were alive with conflicting information. The only truth was that 75 nobles, including Lord Blackstone himself, had died during the battle, which, surprisingly, the North had won, taking few other casualties. The fewest casualties had been amongst the light infantry, which usually took the heaviest toll. As a result, Blackstone leadership was thrust into chaos, a power struggle that had caused King Garrick himself to attend the city to sort things out. "I heard the Dread King plans to move the capital to Blackstone and assume power there himself," one man said.
"Well, I heard the king was murdered by Lord Blackstone's 3 sons, who then fought each other to the death."
"Well, I heard."
Opinions continued to swirl like snowflakes, though little of it was likely true. Rose Fay only listened to the idle talk, waiting for a time when her old name was mentioned, along with the declaration of a reward for her capture. She remembered when she'd first arrived in this city. She was exhausted and starving and cold and nearly penniless, but she'd managed to procure a room for the night and a warm meal. Staring into a smudged mirror in her room, she'd used the blunt knife provided with her meal to shear away her long black hair until it was short enough that she almost resembled a boy. As she watched her hair fall away, it had almost felt like she herself was fading away, at least the old her. The person she saw staring back at her was someone new, without a past, without a history, without baggage or memories or sadness or loss or the blood of hundreds on her hands. That word, fade. That word. It had felt right. Real. Fade. Fade. Fade.
"Yes, that is who I am now. I am Fader, and I am a blacksmith."
She shook her head, and the memory vanished. Though she felt relatively safe, at least for now, she was also bored. It wasn't that she didn't have plenty of work. Walberg was as desperate for blacksmiths as any other city. It was the type of work she now did. She'd gone from designing armor and weapons for the most powerful lord in the north, besides the king himself, to constructing farm equipment and tools as basic as hoes and shovels. "It pays for my food and my shelter and my clothing," she thought, trying not to be greedy. "And this jug of mead," she added, taking another sip, relishing the warmth in her chest as the strong amber liquid slid down her throat. And yet she wanted more. That's when she realized the loud talk in the tavern had moved on to another subject. Apparently a tourney was coming, an annual event that seemed to breathe life into the cold, stalwart city.
17 knights are competing this year," one man said. 2 more than last year."
"It'll be the biggest tournament yet,"
another said.
"Even Sir Darius is competing."
"Sir Darius?"
a woman said, pretending to faint, earning herself a round of raucous laughter.
"I won't bet against him, that's for sure."
And on and on. But Fay wasn't really listening any more. She was thinking. Perhaps she couldn't design weaponry and armor for war any more. No. But she could design it for competition.
almost 2 years later. Fay owned her own smithy in Walburg now. Over the months, her fame had grown. It had all started with that first tournament. While sneaking around the tournament grounds, she'd heard one of the knights, Sir Draconius, berating the blacksmith who travelled with him. In the end, the knight had fired his man, and she had pounced. The knight had won the tournament using her armour and a longsword of her own design, but had then refused her future services because he couldn't have a woman smith in his employ. But that hadn't mattered, because Fay had regained something far more important than another master. She'd earned her reputation back. Now she was her own master, serving various competitors in the tournaments that came through Walburg, which were now more frequent, occurring 3 to 4 times a year. She didn't discriminate either. She was as likely to outfit a commoner as she was a knight, and her only goal was to give them as good a chance to win as she could. Most of her customers came back for more weapons and armour, like the hot steel she was currently pounding into shape with a heavy hammer, like the massive spiked ball hanging on the wall nearby. She paused in her hammering to gaze at the weapon, as she often did. Attached to the spiked ball was a long chain that ran down to a fine handle, delicately designed with contours that would fit into a strong grip. She'd been working on it for months, fine-tuning every aspect of it until it was perfect. There was only one problem. It was too large for most, or any, men to wield. "The Morning Star," she thought, sighing. That was the name she had given the weapon, because when it shone in the light, it was like stepping from home in the morning and staring up at the sky only to find the brightest star fighting off the sunlight to showcase its desperate beauty. The sound of approaching footsteps drew her away from the weapon, and she resumed her hammering until the door opened. One of her best customers entered, a man who sponsored competitors, a man she grudgingly considered a friend, even if he was something of a snake, driven by lust for coin more than a desire to help those he sponsored. This man, Bart was his name, stood just inside the door, a half-smile creasing his lips. Though small in stature and on the wrong end of age 50, the sponsor was far from frail, his arms thick and his shoulders broad. He had the kind of face only a mother could love, with a crooked nose that had been broken too many times, the surrounding area pocked with scars and imperfections. Lagging slightly behind him was a mammoth of a man, half again as tall as Bart, and hulking with hidden muscles. But that wasn't all that was hidden. His face was wrapped in a thick scarf, only his eyes visible, staring out darkly and somewhat bewildered. Even without being able to see his expression, Fay thought there was something contradictory about him, an innocence wrapped in danger. She pretended not to stare. "Fay," Bart said. "Meat, choose." As she slid the hot steel into a cool bath, steam hissing up and curling toward the rafters, Fay's eyes darted once to the Morning Star, before returning to the large man. "Yes," she thought, feeling for the first time since she ran away from Blackstone that she had a destiny. And the Morning Star did, too.
Postlude 3. Helmuth Garrick. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill, circa 493. The wizened old man named Jorg was young Helmuth's favourite storyteller in the castle. Though Jorg's gnarled hands shook when he waved them, something Helmuth's younger brothers, Wulfric and Griswold, liked to mock and mimic, Helmuth thought it only added to the suspense and darkness of his stories. And for him, the darker the better. Helmuth loved the stories of bloody battles in faraway lands, of unlikely heroes, of the defeat and taming of dragons. And right now, the story Jorg was telling was Helmuth's kind of story. He ignored his brother's tittering and whispers as he leaned forward, elbows on withered knees. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw his sister, Zelda, who was his youngest sibling at only age 6, leaning forward too. Though her disposition was sullen and she was prone to frequent outbursts and rants, she was by far his favourite of his siblings. For one thing, she never mocked him for his inability to walk without crutches, or how his legs were too thin and weak, or that he would probably never be able to wield a sword the way his brothers could. But all that was forgotten as the storyteller continued to spin his yarn,
the firelight dancing across his wrinkled face.
"The lesser have been hunted for generations by the Crimeans, but they are like cockroaches. You kill one, and 10 more seem to spring up from the very ground. They are a disparate migratory species, each tribe fighting for dominance of the others. It is even said they eat their own dead."
Each word made Helmuth's heart hammer harder.
"Cannibals," he thought.
"Why are they called the lesser?"
he asked. Wulfric sniggered and whispered something to Griswold. Griswold pushed him and Wulfric shoved him back. Helmuth ignored their camaraderie, for he would never be a part of it. They had 2 good legs each, and he had none, which seemed to separate their worlds like walls divided 2 rooms, and there was no door between them, not even a window. The storyteller showed his yellow teeth.
"The name was coined by one of the Crimean kings, Marcus Strait II. Most think it is because they are like humans, but believed to be of lesser intelligence. Perhaps we evolved from them. Perhaps not. No one knows."
"What do they look like?"
The man's eyes twinkled, which, Helmuth knew, meant he was about to say something intended to be shocking.
"There is not much difference between the males and females, though the females are larger, their claws sharper, their fangs longer."
At that, Wulfric and Griswold finally ceased their whispering. Wulfric said,
"You mean to tell us the females are more powerful than the males?"
There was incredulity in his tone. Zelda, for her part, seemed excited by the prospect, though her way of showing it was to simply bare her white teeth in something akin to a smile. Jorg nodded heavily.
"An expert swordsman might survive an encounter with a male, but when facing a female..."
He shook his head and made a cutting motion with his finger across his throat.
"Bollocks," Wulfric said. "I would cut the beast to ribbons and not break a sweat."
Though he was only 11 years old, Helmuth's middle brother had the confidence of a king. He was his father's son through and through.
"Believe what you will,"
was Jorg's response, one he'd used many times in the face of Wulfric's skepticism.
"The lesser are hairless, their backs ridged and humped. They walk stooped, their long arms nearly reaching the ground. Though they enjoy killing with their claws and fangs, they also fashion weapons from the bones of their victims."
"You think this is going to scare us, old man, but it's not,"
Wulfric cut in.
"I've never heard of these lesser barbarians. If they truly existed, the Crimeans would have wiped them off the face of the earth by now."
Jorg, as usual, was the image of composure. Though baited often, he never rose to it, something Helmuth secretly enjoyed, if only because of how much he knew it irritated Wulfric. He held back a smile, interested to hear the storyteller's response.
"You don't think they've tried?"
There was a hint of mocking in the man's voice, and Helmuth almost gasped. Wulfric glared at him, but Jorg didn't react, just continued speaking in his rich, practiced voice.
"The Crimeans have gone to war against the lesser more than a dozen times over the centuries. Every time they've lost."
"Ha! The Crimeans couldn't even defeat us. We drove them back 2. They are not the world powers they once were. When I am king, I will extend our lands to Crimea, and I will exterminate the lesser like the rodents they are."
Helmuth felt his cheeks warm. Wulfric often spoke of the kingdom passing to him, though that was impossible so long as Helmuth was alive. By birthright, he would be king, not Wulfric. He knew he should stand up for himself, should speak in his own defence, but his voice always failed him in these situations. Zelda's, however, did not.
"You be king? We'd be better off with an ice bear sitting the throne."
"Take it back."
"I will not. And Helmuth is older. He will be king, not you."
Wulfric stood, his chest heaving, his hands fisted at his sides. He looked ready to hit his younger sister. Zelda, of course, didn't know the meaning of fear, and she merely stuck out her jaw as if daring him to do just that. Jorg, using a tactic he'd employed to diffuse tensions amongst the siblings before, continued speaking as if nothing had changed.
"The barbarians do not fight like our armies. They have no rules of combat, no leaders. Each tribe is its own organism, and the attacks come not in organized lines, but in waves."
Though Wulfric's eyes continued shooting arrows at Zelda, he sat. Zelda giggled.
"They live in the mountains, the northern fangs, hiding in caves and burrows. They fear nothing. Some say they number in the thousands, some say tens of thousands, but no one really knows, for they cannot be counted. But if they ever manage to unify..."
The old man trailed away, the look in his eyes growing distant.
"What?"
Helmuth said, intrigued, unable to hold back the question.
"Frozen gods help us all."
Wulfric snorted.
"You believe this rot? Come on, Gris. I tire of old men who try to scare children with their nonsense. We are practically men grown, and we no longer must keep the company of girls and cripples."
He stood and departed. The words stung, but Helmuth pretended to let them slide off his back. In reality, they clung to him like a thick fog. Griswold, 2 years Wulfric's younger, didn't look as certain, but he managed to plaster a half-sneer on his face and follow in his brother's wake. A weight seemed to lift off Helmuth's shoulders as soon as they were gone. He hated the effect they had on him, but he couldn't help it. Though they were younger, long had he desired their approval, and longer had they denied him. He gritted those thoughts between his teeth and refocused on Yorg. "Is the story real? Do the Lesser really exist?"
"The best stories are the true ones,"
the old man said, his lip curling. He stood, gathered his cane, and hobbled off. Zelda leapt to her feet and said,
"If the Lesser come here, I will run them through."
She brandished a wooden sword that should have been too heavy for such a young girl, but which she handled with ease, cutting and slashing. Helmuth, more slowly, pushed from the log to his feet, propping himself up with one crutch and using the other to sword fight with his sister. She didn't take it easy on him, and despite her young age was a fierce warrior in her own right. Still, his size and strength advantage eventually allowed him to disarm her, and he hated the pride he felt at the victory.
"Sure, you can defeat a child, and a girl no less," he thought.
As they walked back inside the castle, his mind drifted back to the old man's story. The Lesser, like him, had been underestimated by their enemies, yet they'd always emerged victorious. The thought brought a thin smile to Helmuth's lips.
"Let them underestimate me," he thought. "I will not be the maimed prince forever. One day, I will be king."
"I'm sorry, son,"
Helmuth's father said. His hands were clasped together regally as he sat on the edge of Helmuth's bed. King Garrick, despite being the most powerful man in the North, a man who'd a dozen times over earned himself the nickname the Undefeated King, looked as uncomfortable as Helmuth had ever seen him. Helmuth was struggling to understand.
"Sorry for what?"
His father refused to look at him, and though Helmuth closed his mind off to the truth, he could sense it sliding around the edges.
"No, it cannot be."
But it could be.
Of course it could. "The North requires a strong leader, especially in these times, when our enemies surround us like winter storms."
"And I am not strong."
Helmuth hated his own words, not because they hurt, but because they were true. His father didn't deny it, had never denied it.
"Son, I love you with the very core of my being. None of this is your fault. You were born this way. You have your own talents, but you are no warrior."
Helmuth grabbed his crutches and leapt to his feet, determined to show his father he had more to offer than he knew. He shoved one crutch under his armpit and attempted to wield the other like a sword, like he had the night before against Zelda. This time, however, one of his feet snagged on the space between tiles and his crutch tangled with his legs. He felt himself falling headfirst, and he knew the impact would be painful. Strong arms caught him just before his face smashed into the ground. In some ways, it was worse than if he'd blooded his nose. His father was right.
I am no warrior.
His father hadn't told anyone of his decision yet, but Helmuth still felt like people were looking at him differently, pityingly.
The poor boy,
he could feel them saying.
No good legs to stand on, and now no kingdom either.
He has nothing. No reason to live. Tears stung his eyes, and before he could blink them away, they dribbled down his cheeks and dripped from his chin.
"Oh, is the little maimed prince sad?"
a voice said, mocking, harsh. Helmuth wanted to run away and not look back, but, of course, he could not move faster than an awkward hobble. Slowly, he turned to face Wulfric, who was flanked closely by Griswold.
"It's sweat, not tears,"
Helmuth lied, wiping away the moisture.
"You have to move fast to sweat,"
Wulfric said. Helmuth had no response to that.
"Crippled fool,"
Wulfric said, starting to turn away.
"I'm not a fool,"
Helmuth said. He couldn't reject the crippled part, but he had a brain and knew how to use it. Wulfric spat on the ground.
"You think you're going to be king some day? That makes you a fool."
Helmuth blushed, his father's words coming back to him in a rush.
"You are no warrior."
Anger coursed through him as his brothers turned their backs on him as though he weren't worth another moment of their time. He wanted to hurt them, to punish them for their constant japes and insults, for wounding him without laying a finger on him. Without thinking, he extended his crutches and swung himself forward in a long stride. They made a clopping, creaking sound, giving him away. Wulfric started to turn back, but Helmuth was already bringing one crutch up, whipping it around, aiming for his brother's,
"I can't believe I'm doing this,"
he thought, even as he did it, head. Wulfric's hand shot up and grabbed the heel of the wooden crutch from mid-air, stopping it to a hair's breadth from his jaw. His eyes were alight with a fire Helmuth had never seen in them before. That stare was stripped of all mockery and insult, the void filled with darkness and rage.
"You shouldn't have done that,"
he growled. He ripped the crutch from Helmuth's hand, sweeping a leg out to kick away the other one. Without anything to lean on, his legs crumbled and he fell awkwardly, which was the only way he knew how to fall. The impact was jarring, his bones rattling inside his skin. Helpless, he looked up at Wulfric and saw the truth of what his brother could really be, what he could become. Aye, he was a bully, but not only that. No, in that vengeful stare, he saw the eyes of a killer. And then it was gone, his expression returning to one of scorn. He kicked Helmuth once in the ribs, curling him into the fetal position, and then stalked off, laughing the whole way. A noise jarred Helmuth from sleep. He cocked his head, listening. The castle was always silent at night, like an exhausted beast slumbering after a day of hunting its prey. Silence. Silence. And then a muffled cry, almost inaudible through the thick stone walls. Helmuth grabbed his useless legs with his arm and slung them over the edge of the bed in one swift motion. It was almost graceful, though he could only seem to achieve such things when no one was watching, save perhaps Zelda. He grabbed his crutches and thrust them into place. He eased forward, cautious in the dark. He opened his door and swiveled left, then right, listening. No other sounds emerged. He went right first, pressing his ear to Zelda's door. Nothing. He pushed it open quietly to find his sister sprawled crookedly across her bedsheets. Her wooden sword was still clutched in one hand, resting on her chest, which rose and fell with the swells of deep sleep. He closed the door and went the other way. Wulfric's room was next after his own, and he could see the telltale line of orange light beneath the door. He considered knocking, but then realized he didn't care about such manners any more. Instead, he thrust open the door without preamble. What he saw surprised him. Wulfric's eyes were huge as he turned toward him. He was shirtless, the contours of a chest that was showing the beginnings of true muscle evident in the lantern light. His night trousers were down to his knees, his pale legs like columns of snow.
"Get out,"
he hissed. and though Helmuth knew he should probably obey, he couldn't, his feet frozen. Because he'd already seen the truth, his mind ticking over the facts, lining them up like tin soldiers about to do battle. The covers were stripped from the bed, piled in the corner. His brother's trousers, though hard to make out in the dim light, were wet. His underclothes were even worse, drenched in a spreading patch around his crotch. And he understood. The shame of not having control of one's own body. The pity he could already feel in his own expression. The sadness mixed with something hotter, more potent. The anger. Wulfric ripped off his pants and stalked toward him in only his underclothes.
"I said, get out," he said, pressing his face close, his breath hot and stale.
For some reason, Jorg's story came back to him in that moment. The lesser. Believed to be less worthy of life because of how they were born, hunted, exterminated. But they could never be defeated.
"I'm telling father," Helmuth said coolly,
though his heart was hammering in his chest. Wulfric's mouth fell open. He grabbed Helmuth's shirt in a fist.
"I'll kill you."
It was no threat. No, they were far beyond that now. It was a promise.
"Perhaps,"
Helmuth said, forcing his stare to meet his brother's. This was the most important moment in his life, he knew.
"But then you'll have to make it look like an accident. Cover it up. Things will get messy."
Wulfric's eyes narrowed, cool, calculating.
"What do you want? For me to stop with the nicknames? For me to stop hurting you? Fine. You aren't worth another second of my time. So long as you promise to never breathe a word of this night to anyone, I'll leave you alone."
It was just like Wulfric to think things could be so easy. Life had always been easy for him, after all. But that wasn't what Helmuth wanted. He wanted what was rightfully his, or at least a chance at it.
"No, brother. I want the opposite. I want to fight you."
"What?" Wulfric scoffed.
"You heard me. I want an official duel. The winner takes the crown."
Wulfric shoved him away.
"That's ridiculous."
But Helmuth could see the gleam in his eyes, for he didn't yet know their father intended to give him the throne already.
"Fine. It's your choice," Helmuth said,
impressing even himself with the casualness of his tone. He started to turn away.
"Wait."
Helmuth turned back, holding back a smile.
"You'll have your duel, brother, and I shall have my throne."
They presented their plan to their father the next day. It was a closed meeting, which, in hindsight, was a mistake.
"No,"
King Garrick said, much to both their surprise.
"What?"
they said at the same time.
"But, father,"
Wulfric said,
"I forbid it. I will not have the two of you brawling like common ruffians. And only I decide who shall sit the throne when I die." "Father,"
Wulfric tried to interject again.
"I said no. And anyway..."
His eyes met Helmuth's, a million unspoken words passing between them.
"The throne is already Wulfric's. I made the decision 2 days ago."
Wulfric's eyes snapped to Helmuth's.
"You knew?"
Helmuth was caught, and there was no way to hide it. He'd thought if he showed his father he was willing to fight for what was rightfully his, that he would see the real him, the heart of the warrior trapped inside a crippled body. But he'd failed, and his father saw only his shriveled legs and crutches.
"You're a snake,"
Wulfric spat.
"Watch it, brother,"
Helmuth said. He felt numb. He'd lost the only thing he had left, and there was nothing else for them to take away. Next to the crown, his life felt like such a small thing. Wulfric's lips clamped shut, and Helmuth felt a swell of satisfaction. He considered whether to tell their father about his brother's wet bedsheets now, or lord it over him for a while longer. In the end, the decision was stripped away from him, much like the crown had been.
"I should never have protected your secret, Helmuth,"
Wulfric said, his tone softening. Helmuth stared at him, not understanding. Not quite yet.
What are you talking about, son?
The king said. And Helmuth understood, but it was like watching a runaway cart tumble down a hill.